This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zach McCulley, and today I'm joined by Dr. Daryl G. Hart, who has written a new book with Oxford University Press called Benjamin Franklin, Cultural Protestant. Dr. Hart is Distinguished Professor of History at Hillsdale College and author of numerous books on Protestantism in the U.S. And I'm glad he's here to speak with us today about this new book, Dr. Hart. Daryl, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Sure. Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know this isn't your first time on the New Books Network, but for some of our listeners who may be less familiar with your work, maybe you can tell us just a little bit more about yourself.
How could that be? People unfamiliar. So I have been at Hillsdale College for 11 years, probably the best period of my career for a host of reasons. But I went to Johns Hopkins for my PhD in American religious history, where I did an intellectual biography of J. Gresham Machen, the New Testament scholar and Presbyterian conservative who was all over the fundamentalist controversy. And since then, I have written a lot about American religion and politics, American higher education, especially religious studies, a book that I am somewhat proud of. I hope not in a sinful way. The University Against Religion, which was my second book on the history of the formation of religion as an academic discipline in American universities, which involves a lot of history of Protestantism as a backdrop to that. And then I've also been working on the history of Reformed Protestantism in various contexts. I guess the big title there is a 2013 book, I guess, what I did with Yale called Calvinism, A History, that's largely transatlantic. I work in some African and Asian themes, especially through missions. That's a little bit of, I grew up in Philadelphia area, suburbs of Philadelphia, Temple undergrad. I still am a Philly boy in a lot of ways. And like the East Coast, that's probably my only regret about Hillsdale, Michigan, is that I'm as far removed from the East Coast as my wife and I are.
That's great. Thank you for that. So getting to this new book on Franklin, it's part of this OUP series on spiritual lives, sort of recasting some prominent figures in new ways, and thinking about how these figures sort of navigated different religious questions. So why Franklin? How does he, as your subtitle mentions, as a cultural Protestant, how does he fit into this series?
Well, I think the series, I can't speak for the editor, Timothy Larson, who teaches at Wheaton, and he was actually after me to write to, he wanted my book on H.L. Mencken, which I did in the biography series that Erdmans does, but I was already committed to Erdmans. So I suggested Franklin to Tim, and he said that was great. And I think what he's trying to do is to capture prominent people in all walks of life and explore the religious or spiritual dimension. And I'm not sure how much I really thought about the differences between spirituality or being spiritual versus being religious. And I know there's a lot of attention to that right now in trying to understand Americans, at least, and nuns and those different categories that pollsters use. But I think the big endeavor with the series is to find figures of prominence in the past and explore their religious backgrounds and even surprising aspects of the lives that may have a religious significance. My wife is reading now their, they did a biography of Christine Rossetti, poet, hymn writer. And I know one of the first volumes was Barry Hankins, who did a spiritual biography of Woodrow Wilson. Tim Larson did, himself did John Stuart Mill. So again, sort of big names, people not associated with religious or church or Christian history, and then trying to figure them out. In my own case, with Franklin, as I explain in the preface, I think, pretty sure that's where it is, I went to Ben Franklin Junior High, played in the marching band, played middle guard on the football team. I mean, it doesn't matter what I did there, but that was, so Franklin was just a presence. We took field trips as suburban kids to the Franklin Institute, which is Philadelphia's science museum. He has various institutions in the Society Hill or the historic parts of Philadelphia. So he's just a prominent figure in Philadelphia life. He established a number of institutions there that I was probably unaware of even as a Temple student. But so he was always intriguing. And at Hillsdale, we have a course that all the faculty teach, one of the core courses in American heritage. And we have excerpts in the reader from his autobiography. And he's always struck me as a very intriguing figure. So I was glad, for Philadelphia reasons, as well as religious history reasons, and even colonial history, which I dabble in. I'll be teaching colonial America this fall at Hillsdale, not necessarily trained in it, but it's only at a 300 level. It's not, say, advanced work on it. It's more coverage than going deep. And so I like that period. I like thinking about America before it was America. And I've been struck by the affinities between the United Kingdom and North America, which includes Canada. And so Franklin gave me a chance to think through some of those matters. It also made it really attractive that so much of his writing is available online. So I didn't have to do necessarily a lot of work in archives, which I didn't do, but.
Yeah, very good. Well, you know, you have this part of the beginning about Franklin's early years, which seem really important in terms of just understanding his experiences and exposure to religious ideas that would come to have some influence on him. But there was more than just sort of the old influence of Puritanism on Franklin as a youth. And I'm wondering if you can tell us some about that. Were there other social, cultural expectations, about how to live, what to do, that Franklin learned as a boy, that came to have some influence?
Well, he was, his parents were devout. I mean, we know mainly about his parents through Franklin himself. One of the interviews I did was for a website called fivebooks.com, and they ask for the best five, they ask authors for the best five books on a particular, on the subject of their writing. And so they asked me to do something on Franklin. And one of the books that I used for Franklin's youth, just extraordinary book by Arthur Burnin Tortolo, T-O-U-R-T-E-L-L-O-T, but that's at fivebooks.com. People can find that if they want to go there. And it covers Franklin only up until maybe he gets to Philadelphia, which is roughly 1726 or so. And it's great coverage of what Boston was like when he was growing up. But the parents were devout. They were members at Third Church or Old South Church, which is still going. The building is there too. I'm not sure if it's the building that he was going to church in. They wanted him to be a minister as the 10th child of his father. And this was sort of like a tithe of his children to the church to prepare Ben to go off to the ministry. And he went to Boston Latin for a brief bit, but over time the father was, and I think this is actually telling, the father was not so doctrinaire that he kept pushing his son to go into the ministry. He understood that maybe Ben wasn't cut out for this, not because he wasn't sufficiently smart, but because he wasn't perhaps as devout or as committed as he needed to be. So they tried to find a trade for the son, and Ben Franklin's father was a candle maker, but that was really dull. So eventually they found an apprenticeship for Ben with his older brother, James, who was a printer and publisher. And that's what gave Franklin in part an appetite for print and news and publishing. So he grew up in this religious culture. The reputation of Boston is one of Orthodox Puritanism, I guess, some renderings of it. Although I think by the time Franklin was born in 1706, especially with the various episodes and generations of Puritanism in Massachusetts, it was not what it was when John Winthrop arrived, say, 80 years earlier or so, so I don't know that it was as orthodox an environment. There were certainly restrictions on what people could do because of that religious presence. And there were expectations for certain kinds of conduct, going to church, et cetera. Franklin talked about devotional life in the home, singing psalms with his parents at home, certain kinds of devotional literature at home. But my sense too is that Boston was relatively fluid within a very narrow range of Protestantism, but that Franklin could find other outlets there than simply having to think about being a good Puritan boy all the time.
You know, it's early in his life that you tell us where he begins to write some about deism. And it's probably often the case that Franklin is sort of looked at as a deist, you know, through and through. But the picture you sort of give us here, it's more nuanced than that. And Franklin's his deism, it changes over time. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. The odd thing about deism is that it's not as if someone can be a card-carrying deist the way you could be a card-carrying Congregationalist or Methodist or Presbyterian. And Franklin was certainly an early deist in the North American setting, when you look at some of the prominent deists, say, for instance, Thomas Jefferson or other names are escaping me right now, but they're much younger than Franklin by at least a generation, if not more. And I guess Ethan Payne is another prominent one whose name comes to mind. And he actually did, as I recall, form some kind of deist society. And nothing like that existed for Franklin. Franklin wrote a dissertation basically on predestination and free will while he was working in London. He had a brief time where he went over to try to find some printing, a printer device for a fellow back in Philadelphia that he was going to bring it back. And that deal blew up. And so Franklin had to live in London for a time. And he hung out in the coffee culture. He was exposed to a lot of Enlightenment ideas. He was always exposed to that. He was a voracious reader. And so he was fitting in with a Lockean, moderate Anglican Enlightenment outlook. And as a young man, and I think most young people are prone to excesses that they have to pull back from later in life, he went full in with a kind of a deistical God who really was quite arbitrary in the way he set things up. But Franklin had all of those copies, or at least most of those copies of the dissertation, destroyed. I think there were practical reasons for that. He didn't want to get a reputation back in Philadelphia when he returned of being a kind of Socrates figure who had these bad ideas that would harm the youth or something. He wanted to be a successful businessman. He needed to be conventional in certain ways. So that would be a reason why he pulled back in a certain respect. But I think he was a playful person, and he played with ideas. He played with all sorts of things. I mean, I think his scientific experiments were part of that playfulness to see how things would work, see what would work, what wouldn't work. And he did this early on with these ideas that it's easy to classify as deist, so that he didn't believe Jesus was divine. But I don't know what he also thought about the Holy Spirit per se. So he wasn't Trinitarian. He probably could have been a Unitarian by the 19th century, but that wasn't available to him. He had a high regard for the Bible, had a high regard for Christian morality. He had a sense that there would be a comeuppance after death. You would be rewarded according to your goodness or punished according to your wickedness. But he just didn't buy the most redemptive aspects of Christianity. And I think that's why it's easiest to put him in the deist classification.
Right. Right. That makes sense. I want to ask about his moral thinking, where Franklin he's separating virtue from faith. And he's seeing his effort, that striving and pursuit of, perfecting the moral life. He's seeing that as virtuous. I'm wondering if you can sort of speak to how Franklin here is. I mean, he's drawing upon and diverging from Puritan thought, it seems, because on the one end, Franklin's, you know, the Protestant heritage, it would commend that sort of resolute attitude toward upright living, but at the same time may disagree on sort of the nature, the source of those,
right,
those efforts.
Yeah. Well, it's always struck me that when Jonathan Edwards converted around, he was 18 or so, but this is something from the early 1720s, that Edwards had a plan for a kind of, if not perfection, a kind of really high level devotion that I did compare to Franklin's own resolution. And of course, Franklin is writing about his plan for perfection as part of his autobiography. And he's writing that in the 1770s and 1780s, you know, which, as any good historian would then think, well, how accurate is a man? How accurate is what he's describing? Can we trust him first of all, to describe himself, and can we trust him to remember correctly what he was up to? But he did save some fragments too. So there's a chart in his autobiography of the virtues that he sought, and he would put little dots about how he did on that particular day with regard to those virtues. It's almost like a spreadsheet from the 18th century. But there's something in the water among New England Protestants and heirs of Puritanism that would put Franklin and Edwards on a similar path toward the pursuit of a really high and demanding moral life. And of course, Edwards would give an account very different from Franklin's. There is within the Protestant tradition, I don't know it as well, but I would guess it's there among Roman Catholics, of a civic virtue as opposed to a spiritual or Christian virtue, that there are benefits for people who aren't Christians but still pursuing the moral life. It's good for society, it's good for families, etc. And I think that's one way that Franklin could have also come to this, by thinking that these are virtues that make society, make people, make families work really well. He was a very practical person. But the other side of this too is he did have an illegitimate son, William. And to the best of my knowledge, I don't go deep into Franklin sources or keep up with all the literature that is published, although I do keep up with anything written online that Google Alerts will send me. It seems that we still don't know who the woman was, who the mother of William Franklin was, which really is an amazing aspect of the past that has remained hidden. But I say that only because I wonder if Franklin had real regrets over that kind of indiscretion and thought he really needed to make up for that and pursue some kind of life with moral purpose and make sure that didn't happen again. Now, he admits in his autobiography that he wasn't good at this plan, and that pride was the most difficult of sins to overcome. And he also had a thing for the ladies. He carried on correspondence with younger women that was quite flirtatious. There's a French aristocratic woman he meets while he's a diplomat later in life that it doesn't seem like he had an affair, but it was certainly they carried on in ways that could have led to an affair, let's say that. And so it's not as if Franklin sort of just had a complete reversal in his life, but I do think wanting to overcome the indiscretion of having a son out of wedlock, as well as wanting to be a respectable businessman in a city dominated by Quakers who were really very moral, and in some ways on a spectrum of English Protestantism, you could put Church of England perhaps on one side of the spectrum, Quakers maybe on the other side, but close to Quakers in some ways would be Baptists and some of the Puritans as well. So that setting of Philadelphia, I think, led Franklin to be also interested in trying to make sure he walked the straight and narrow.
Yeah, that's really helpful to think about it. You know, another thing to consider here, beyond Franklin as a moral thinker, Franklin as an intellect, is one thing I wanted to ask you about. It may sort of be a misconception that we imagine Franklin's intellectual curiosity or his participation in the sciences as strictly isolated from Protestant thought. But are there sort of threads connecting Franklin and modern science in general to earlier Christian thinking?
Well, I mean, one way that I tried to conceive of that, and I've thought about this too in relation to secularization and the way in which Steve Bruce is somebody, a sociologist. I guess he's English. I know he writes, I know he's British. And I've benefited a lot from his work on secularization. But Protestants like Judaism, this is an argument that Bruce makes somewhere in one of his books, that Protestants really did desacralize the natural world. If Christendom in some ways and Roman Catholic thought led to an idea that everything was sort of incarnational or everything was sacramental, and that medieval Catholic theologians would be much better at making that clear and distinct in ways that I think sometimes modern Roman Catholic thinkers are not. They can be really squishy about that sacramental side of the universe. But Protestants, in emphasizing the transcendence of God and emphasizing the differences between creation and redemption, did provide a space. And there are some historians of science that would argue this, that they created a space for people like Franklin to do much more exploration of the natural world and not have to conceive of it in overtly religious or theological categories beyond, say, a creator who set it up or providence. I mean, providence is a big part of the founders' outlook on the world, Franklin among them, and deists would have also affirmed providence in that way. Sense that God controls all things but not necessarily in a redemptive or salvific way. So I think Franklin fits in that understanding of the history of science and Christianity, especially Protestantism. And so his discovery of the electrical character of lightning. If you look at the explanations of lightning in the 18th century that even Protestants were using, there was oftentimes associating it with some kind of punishment from God for sin. If there was a lightning strike that started a fire, et cetera, this is still part and parcel of the way that Christian, pastors, but even lay people think about, catastrophes or emergencies in the world, that there's some understanding that this is God is judging humankind for this. Franklin wasn't as committed to that, even though he did believe in divine judgment at the end of life for people. And so he was willing to explore the natural dimensions of things. He had an incredible curiosity. One of the aspects of his life that I admire about him the most is just how fascinated he was, a sense of wonder about almost everything around him, from the color of fabrics and how much heat they could retain, to the little critters he saw on the algae on the boat as he's coming back from London to Philadelphia. He just was paying attention to nature all the time. I guess you could call him a naturalist of a kind, even though he wasn't working in nature directly as a printer and editor. But it's just amazing. So he was endlessly curious, endlessly doing all sorts of experiments, and science as it was in the 18th century was very amateur. And there was a community of people doing science. Sometimes historians will call this a republic of letters, people, enlightenment figures who are writing letters back and forth to each other. And Franklin was certainly a part of a network of scholars who were investigating different aspects of science, the Royal Society and the like. And Franklin's in that world. But again, he's not constrained because of his lack of orthodoxy. He's not as constrained to fit what he's finding in a doctrinal grid the way, say, maybe other Protestants may be. So maybe he was taking scientific investigation farther by virtue of not being constrained that way. I don't want to make it seem like orthodoxy is always opposed to science, but it can also give you certain categories that make, that present warning signs if you stray too far from something. And Franklin certainly didn't do that. And because, again, he was almost as playful as he was curious, he just conducted a lot of experiments. And once he retired from the printing business at the young age of 42, I believe, in 1748, he has much more time to do some of these experiments, even though he was also by that point beginning to become very active in politics, first locally and then in the colonies and then, of course, internationally.
Right. Yeah, and I suppose that's a, that's another place to stop and address, you know, beyond the moral, the, and the intellectual is the political, in terms of Franklin's spiritual life. One thing you talk about here is Franklin's ability and willingness, and probably in no small part a reason for success as a leader, this ability to work with those who held different views and who held, you know, different church memberships and that sort of thing. Can you tell us how did Franklin come to prominence in Philadelphia political life, and how did religion especially factor into, sure, into some of his political ideas?
Well, he was a guy, if I can put it that way, always on the make, and I'm not sure I should even put it that way either, but as a man starting out a printing business, and he came to Philadelphia with nothing. He had escaped the indenture with his brother on a kind of technicality, but he really did escape. He shouldn't have left the apprenticeship, the contract under which he was working for his brother. He didn't like that arrangement, and he left when he had an opening. So he came without resources that he might have had he stayed in his apprenticeship, and he had to find his way. It took him a while, took him a few years before he could even set up a business. And then once he does set up a business, he's looking for all sorts of work, and he corners the market on printing currency, printing public documents for government, both New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And so he becomes somebody that the legislators in both those colonies know. And so by the time that he does become independent, man of means, almost a gentleman, he commissions the very first portrait of him. There are many portraits of Franklin. And one of the things that I'm fascinated by in the life of Franklin is the way in which Americans have remembered him and commemorated him with statues and portraits. But the very first portrait of Franklin comes from one that he himself commissions. And Gordon Wood, great historian of the founding era, makes a big deal of Franklin portraying himself as a gentleman in this. He has now made it. And it's one of the least, one of the most artificial of the portraits of Franklin, it seems to me. But he is a successful businessman by this point. He's wealthy enough to live without having to work, and having all those connections in government that he had established as somebody who did a lot of work, a lot of print jobs for a lot of different institutions, among them political, he was ready to go. And so he begins to serve in the Pennsylvania Assembly. He's also, even before there are such agencies within civic government, like a fire department, like a police department, he's already forming institutions like that. He helps to get the first fire department going. He studies, you know, what makes for a really bad fire and figures out ways to try to prevent that. He's interested. He developed his own fireplace, his own stove, the Franklin stove, that they, you know, will heat houses better without creating fires. Again, he's always practical. He establishes first militia when the English are beginning to have to do battle with the French and Native Americans. So he's also not simply working for the assembly He's also a postmaster general, but he's also doing, he's forming these organizations that we take for granted now as part of urban civic life. So he just kind of naturally rises up to become a figure of that people trust. He doesn't really hold power, it seems to me, in a way, say, a governor would, like a Winthrop, who John Winthrop, who's governor of Colonial Massachusetts early on. He doesn't have that kind of power, and I wonder if he lacked that kind of ambition, or if he just wasn't temperamentally suited to that. But he was somebody who knew how things operated. He was a transactional kind of politician, and very useful to have around, especially for conducting negotiations, both as the colonists themselves try to organize to fight off the French, and eventually as the colonists also organize to try to gain independence from Britain. And by that point, his usefulness as a negotiator, there are lots of founders like John Adams who are suspicious of Franklin. They don't necessarily think he's the most upstanding of people. They don't necessarily always trust his instincts for what's good for the colonies and good for independence. But he has so much experience. He knows so many different people. He's been such a glad hander that it's really hard to get rid of him as well. And so he just keeps to climb the ladder as a public figure. Again, not someone who held an office of great prominence. He did hold offices along the way, but as someone who just seems to know how to get things done.
Well, Daryl, I want to ask about this list you include at the end of the book that represents a spectrum of Anglo-American Protestant heritage. And you suggest that, if some people on this list, you list Cromwell, Theodore Roosevelt, John Locke, if they're counted among that heritage from Puritanism down to mainline Protestantism, then why not Franklin? And as we're wrapping up now, I want to ask. I'm just wondering if you could, maybe comment on why you think it is that Franklin is typically left off a list like that, and is there significance to his religious legacy that maybe indicates he should be included?
Yeah. Milton. John Milton is someone else that I don't remember if I put on that list, but should be. Milton's a really fascinating character who starts as a Puritan, works closely with Cromwell, and then kind of goes off the rails. Another figure, very highly regarded, is Abraham Lincoln, such that someone like Mark Knoll would argue Lincoln is maybe the best theologian of the Civil War, which I think may be a little overdone, even though I have great respect for Mark. I guess one way to answer this is Franklin never did join a church, the way that others did. And he attended, probably not regularly. His wife, Deborah, was a member at Christ Church, Philadelphia, the Anglican church there. And Franklin rented a pew for her and the family. And he was very cordial with the priests there. But he never took any vows to become a member. And that would be one factor, even though you should also add that he was, he's buried in that church cemetery in Philadelphia with his family. So that would be one factor. And I think that's a pretty good one. I mean, if you don't actually join a church, it makes it hard for you to be considered a Christian, although these days, all you need to do is have Jesus in your heart and you're a Christian. So the other side of it, too, perhaps, is that Protestants at the time when he died didn't rise up to valorize him the way, say, that Protestants did with other figures who may not have been as great. Here I'm thinking especially of Lincoln. Course, with his assassination, that turns him into a martyr kind of figure. Having been martyred on Good Friday, that even raises the stakes to do that. But there wasn't the rallying of support from the church community to Franklin that there would have been for other figures, which I think is another factor in it. And I think some of the major biographers of Franklin have used Franklin less for religious purposes and more for an enlightenment or secular purposes. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. That's certainly a part of who Franklin was. But I also think he was as steeped in a Puritan environment growing up. He was as cooperative with a Quaker society as he was in Philadelphia. And he played around with religion in ways that were not abrasive. So, for instance, one of the things he worked on when he was in London in the 1770s was a revised version of the Book of Common Prayer. And he wanted to make the services shorter, et cetera, so that people in the winter wouldn't have to sit in cold churches as long. All sorts of practical reasons for doing that. So he was, I think, always friendly to religion. And of course, one of the topics I do cover in the book that Skip Stout, Harry Stout at Yale, also covered in his biography of Whitfield, he had a really great friendship with Whitfield, this prominent evangelist revivalist during the so-called First Great Awakening. I prefer to call it the First Pretty Good Awakening, using a phrase that Leo Rebuffo used. So he just wasn't hostile to Christianity. And I think the biographers of Franklin who emphasize a more secular scientific enlightenment aspect of him don't always capture the ways in which he was surrounded by, had to work with Christians of all sorts in society at that time, and did so respectfully, I think, in a relatively contented way, maybe even happy about it. So, I guess you still can't really hold him up, except perhaps his plan of virtue as a great figure of Christian expression. And I guess that would be the reason why he doesn't measure up.
Well, great. I appreciate your answers there, and we're grateful too for your time. I'm sure our listeners are appreciative of you lending your time here to talk about Franklin. Before we go, though, I want to ask maybe if you can give us a heads up on what you plan to write next.
Well, excuse me. I would like, after this current writing project, which I'll say something about, I'd like to do something with Crawford Gribben and I are talking about doing a book on Christian nationalism in Britain and America, with all the attention of late to that. Currently I'm writing a book that's related to this, which is about Presbyterians and British politics from the 16th century down to the 19th century, looking at England, Scotland, Ireland, United States and Canada under the sort of heading of, were Presbyterians inherently rebellious or revolutionary, since so many people attribute the American Revolution to Presbyterianism. And I'm trying to unpack that, but it is striking to me that Presbyterians, being as zealous as they were for reforming church government, getting rid of bishops, they introduced an element into Anglo-American politics that is, I think, different from other European countries and societies. So I'm trying to follow that through and look at the Presbyterian contributions to politics in those different countries.
Very good. We'll definitely have to look out for that. For now, though, thank you for writing this book. It's called Benjamin Franklin, Cultural Protestant. It's out in 2021 with Oxford University Press. And thank you, Daryl, so much for joining me today.
Great to be with you, Zach. I appreciate your good questions. And it was fun to relive some of these moments about Franklin. Thanks.
And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time on New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network.